Heterodorks. Heteroducks dorks.
Hello, Turf. Oh. You know, I had like a good second lead time on you, Nina, so I have to assume that's a deliberate interruption.
I thought you interrupted me.
All right. Ready?
Hello? Hi, hello, turfs and trannies.
Wow.
Things are tense. Wow. Things are tense here at Heterodorks. I'm talking over each other.
I forgive you, though, Nina Paley, my co-host of Heterodorks, because you're such a good person.
And I forgive you, Corinna Cohn, co-host of Heterodorks, because I'm such a good person.
This feels so organic. I love that we don't even script these things. It just happens. And we have a special guest, Heterodork, with us today. She is Kim Jones. She is a fighter for the rights of women in sport. Is that a fair way of putting it, Kim?
Yes.
How would you describe yourself?
Sure, a fighter for the rights of women in sport and women and girls.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Fair.
So you and Corinna know each other, but this is my first time meeting you.
And I feel like I know you though because I've listened to you.
Oh, I see. So, okay. But I need to know more about you, Kim. So my first question is, how did you get into this?
Oh, gosh. I've been into sports for a long time. How did I get into fighting for the rights of women and girls in sports? I think particularly your question is around the idea of gender identity and what it's doing to women and girls in sport. So I am the mother of four kids, and my oldest daughter competed head-to-head against Leah Thomas during the year that Leah was swimming in the Ivy League championships and the Ivy League conference. So had multiple opportunities and had a front row, multiple opportunities to see that in a front row seat to the events that unfolded during the course of that year. And it definitely lit a fire.
And what did you do? Like, what was it like watching this unfold and like...
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you guys aren't allowed to make me cry tonight. It was the worst experience of my life. The reason I am involved in this fight now is because I don't think any other girl or woman should go through it, whether they are an athlete in the competition, a parent observing it, a former athlete of the sport. It was traumatic for almost everyone I spoke to. And my gosh, the women I know that are still in counseling, recovering from the events of that year, it's the amount of depression I saw it's not something I'm willing to just turn around and say, okay, we got through that. Let's work on self-recovery. My self-recovery is going to be preventing this from affecting others. I don't know is that enough of an answer?
There are actually some people out there who don't even know who Leah Thomas is.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you want me to paint the whole picture?
I think that would be good because I'm talking to more people who don't know what's going on.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I will try to recap. So it was early in 2021, the 2021 season. So that means actually late in the year. It's usually around September and October when the swim season kind of picks up. I guess it's October when the swim season picks up. And then there are early dual meets in the Ivy League. You know, these are like, for the course of the season, the teams race each other and they, you know, head to head in either just a dual meet, which is two teams, or a tri meet, which is three teams. And then they'll go to a couple of meets that are bigger meets, travel meets around the country where you'll put on a fast suit and post times to try to qualify for NCAAs or end of season meets. And my daughter was excited because the Ivy League was just getting underway again after a huge break from COVID. The Ivy League was the only conference that didn't compete at all the previous year. They took the year off. So she actually took a gap year that year and worked and continued training, but worked. And so she was excited to be back on campus and back at her sport that she had been doing since she was, you know, 6, 7 years old. And it was, you know, college is kind of the last hurrah for a lot of people in swimming, because it doesn't really go on to, you can, unless you're at an Olympic level, there really isn't a big venue to continue competing. So, you know, it was 2 more years, here we go, this is exciting. And then one of the first dual meets of the season, when you're a parent of swimming, you follow along, like, what are the other teams doing? What are the times that are being posted around the country, and just to be interested in your kid's sport. And I saw some times posted by a swimmer at the University of Penn. And I was shocked, because these were times that were definitely going to make an NCAA championship and be vying for a title at the end of the year, because an unsuited time at those speeds, it was impressive. So just a tiny little bit of digging, and I discovered that this was a man who had swum for 3 years on the men's team and then had decided to compete with the women after coming back from COVID. And they were, of course, these were in my daughter's events that he was going to be racing. So I called her up and I said, did you know that this was going to happen? And she had no idea. I mean, they had no forewarning that that this man was going to be competing with women. No one in the Ivy League knew, even though the girls at Penn had had kind of a heads up that this was happening on their team, or that Leah Will had believed he was a woman and was transitioning. I don't know if they thought that that was actually going to unfold in practice, you know, as like, in practice, meaning become reality on the swim team. But no one at the other schools knew. No one, I mean, apparently the NCAA knew and had been working with the universe, with Penn, to make sure that rules were being followed. But no one had any inclination that this was coming down the pipes. So her reaction was, wow, that's really not fair and not cool. I'm sure they'll take care of it. Like, someone will come in and make sure that things are right. And then the season progressed, right? It started to hit a few news outlets in the swimming community. It became more, as the times got more impressive and whispers started to become talk, there were a few right-leaning news outlets that were posting about it. So it became a little bit more of a public conversation. And then, of course, the Zippy invite happened, which is, these are the big fall invitationals that teams travel to. And at the Zippy invite, Leah posted the fastest times in the country, where it was pretty clear Leah was going to go into the NCAA championships, as if that was allowed to happen, as the top seed in the country. I mean, and Katie Ledecky's and Missy Franklin's unbelievable records for women, just outstanding records for women, were definitely within striking distance of this man. So there was a lot of, all of a sudden it became a lot more of a public conversation. We started recognizing that people weren't stepping up, words weren't being spoken. Newspapers started to gain a lot more interest. My daughter had her picture splashed across news outlets in Australia and in China. She was getting reached out to on social media to make comments, and it was overwhelming. But that was right after the Zippy invite. And then the Ivy League, because of all the media, the Ivy League released a public statement saying that they stood behind Leah and condemned all forms of transphobia. And when the Ivy League made that statement, my daughter texted it to me. They posted it on their social media. And she wrote, "I'm so confused." And I was furious when I saw the post. So I responded straight up. I said, there is absolutely nothing transphobic about respecting the very independent and incomparable accomplishments of female athletes, you know, relative. And I can't remember, it's something like the independent and incomparable accomplishments of female athletes. And my daughter, she was like, oh yeah, that was good. You didn't, but it was one of the, I didn't have any reason to not post that. I didn't understand why anyone would be intimidated. I was ignorant enough at this time to believe that what I was saying was just common sense. And there, I mean, I had been a tennis player in my career where I played at a pretty high level. I was an All-American at Stanford and I represented the U.S. on a U.S. national team. And if I had had to play against a man in tennis, I would have said, no, what are you doing? This is just crazy. But I would have said that even after having grown up and seen friends of mine on the national and international tour working with Renee Richards, whom I'd met and thought was a really lovely person. But I didn't think that would ever happen again. And I thought people had learned their lesson, that this was totally unfair. So I think we thought that was an anomaly. I'm not saying that right. And that was an anomaly. Am I saying that right? Yeah. Something. It was never going to happen again. And so the fact that my daughter was about to face this infuriated me and I wasn't going to sit down and be quiet. But then as soon as they got back to campus, or even later on their bus ride back from whatever trip they were on, she was like, oh, mom, please take that down. Like, people are starting to notice. And that was when I thought, wait, something's fishy here. I'm not taking that down. And then they were pulled in. It was just within a couple days after that, they were pulled into mandatory meetings. All the girls were pulled in by the different Ivy League schools to mandatory meetings that told them they needed to let the NCAA make the rules. This wasn't their fight. This wasn't their place to voice. And, you know, if they thought it was unfair, that their job was to do what they were told. They had signed up for these schools. The schools and their league had made their position clear. So in effect saying like, yeah, you signed up for this. This was part of the bargain. They were told that the trans athletes in their community and the trans students in their community were extremely susceptible to suicide and to mental distress. And it was their job to make sure that no harm came their way.
Can you see the steam coming out of my head while you're relating this story?
I saw you shaking your head. Yes, I do want to read something off to you. I've shared this with a few people, but the Harvard team actually put this in writing, or a little bit of it in writing. Almost all of the teams just did verbal, you know, meetings, and there wasn't any recording. I wish I had them, because after my daughter came out of that meeting, she called me almost immediately, just terrified. She was shaken that she was going to be held accountable. And they were told to keep their families in check, that it was their responsibility to not let their families speak out. They were told to not respond to media or to have, you know, to deal with media inquiries, that they were supposed to check everything they said through their athletic departments or point media inquiries to their athletic departments to let other people speak for them. So it was quite brutal. And especially, I mean, I think especially on young girls at that age, you think about being off in school and you have people in positions of power and authority that you have chosen to follow to that school, like athletic directors and coaches and professors who are supposed to be on that campus to ensure your safety and make sure that you're growing and thriving, right? That's part of their job, right? Is to nurture these young minds, to get them ready to go out and be, you know, ready to conquer the world or to, you know, chase their dreams. And every single voice whispering in their ear was telling them that their primary focus needed to be to affirm this man. And their achievements, their mental health, their hard work that they had put in for decades to get where they were really didn't matter that much. And it certainly didn't matter and when compared to the happiness of one man.
I noticed that in these sorts of circumstances, the athletes, of course, are front and center. And particularly the male who's competing in the women's sport is front and center and gets a lot of media inquiry or coverage. And then behind him would be his competitors. And then behind his competitors would be their families. But the group that I really have never heard of in the media are the administrators who are passing down these directives to the girls to terrify them. Like, who's actually developing these policies that they're imposing on these young athletes, and who's enforcing them? Because these are the people who are really making this happen, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And if I had to hold someone accountable in the Ivy League, it would be Robin Harris. I think that she has abused young athletes and abused her position of power to destroy the health and well-being of so many of the people that she is responsible for. The fact that there was not a single administrator in the Ivy League that stood up and spoke out about this is just infuriates me. They know how many of those girls were in tears. But I want to read the Harvard handout to you you're interested in that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I want to read my interpretation of it, because like all policy that's couched, like it's good, it's propaganda that's made to sound acceptable. And then as soon as you look, you know, just a little bit closer, you can decipher the message that's actually being sent.
Yeah. Yeah. Read us this stuff. And then we're going to ask some follow-ups on that.
Sure. Okay. The conversations and controversy surrounding Leah have been challenging to read. In particular, they focus on what is fair and what is ethical. Regardless of your personal stance, Leah has been incredibly transparent and is abiding by all NCAA rules. That is a fact. Having watched Skylar's transition firsthand, that's Skylar Baylor, I can tell you that if it wasn't for the support of the teams, he may not be here today. Life is more important than politics. It doesn't benefit our team from winning a championship if we spend our collective energy getting annoyed or frustrated. Let the NCAA figure out their next steps. Let us focus on our team. And if any press reaches out, then please direct them to our sports media office and ideally refrain from comment. So that's one paragraph of a meeting that these girls were put in, you know, where the discussions were much longer and more involved. So here's my interpretation, sentence for sentence, on what that is. Let me divert your attention from feeling like something is wrong by asking you to focus on how good Leah has been. Let me emotionally blackmail you into accepting mistreatment, because otherwise you are complicit in a potential death. And Skylar is omnipresent at Harvard, so you will be reminded of this every day. Exchanging your fair treatment for someone else's benefit, a male in this case, is a justifiable cause. And the fair treatment of women is just politics, anyway. While we won't tell you what to do, we're telling you it is a bad choice to fight this. Let the men in charge at the NCAA decide your fate. Immerse your pretty little heads in the team. Let other people decide if you are worthy of fair competition without your input or your voice. Oh, and finally, don't talk.
So just for listeners who don't know who these people are, who is Skylar?
Skylar Baylor is a woman who was recruited to swim at Harvard University on the women's swim team. And then before going to Harvard, decided that she wanted to go through transition medical care. So had a double mastectomy and injected testosterone, and then was granted a position on the men's team at Harvard. So is considered by many to be the first D1 trans athlete, I think, to compete on a men's varsity team.
What's D1?
Division I, that's the highest level of NCAA competition.
So she made it, right? She actually...
Well, she made it, but gratuitously. So there would be no way that Skylar would have been recruited for the men's team at Harvard based on performance, either as a woman or with testosterone treatment. It's interesting to say, you know, that those times would not have been a recruitable time for that level of competition against men. So it was a spot that was handed over to Skylar because Skylar had already been admitted to Harvard. The irony being that that was a spot that, you know, every school at this level gets a certain amount of recruiting opportunity. So you have like 7 spots that you can grant to women who are, you know, going to be a help on your swim team that you want to bring in for that class year. And one of those 7 spots was given to Skylar based on the fact that Skylar was, you know, a stellar academic student, but also would be able to contribute to the women's team at a high level. So was a nationally competitive swimmer. And then to say, I'm not actually going to participate on the team. They don't force you to, once you're accepted into a school, like if you stop swimming or you get hurt, of course, you're still a student. You're a student first. That's why you're supposed to be a student athlete, right? But Skylar would not have been granted a position at Harvard on the men's team. Just would not have been recruited.
And Skylar is so obviously a female name. Does Skylar have a male name that she goes by now, like Stephen or Bruce or Glenn or something like that?
No, it's Skylar Baylor. I don't know if Skylar's name was Skylar before and just stayed the same. I don't know. Okay. It's spelled funny. I often used to say Schuler because it's spelled like S-C-H. You know, okay, you're familiar. Oh.
So is there an X in there too?
No.
Sky Exler?
No.
All right.
And I mean, this is what, so Skylar does trans activism work for a job now.
Wow. Like
helps students, at least previously was helping students, you know, trans students on the Harvard campus. I don't know. I had heard at one point was at least partially employed by Harvard. But I don't know if that's true. I just know that Skylar is around Harvard a lot firsthand from the other student athletes that are attending.
Well, that sounds like a good gig because my work involves editing this podcast and cleaning up Nina's yard. I wonder if I could become a trans
activist
recruiter.
Well, I mean, and I know that Skylar works quite closely with, you know, the ACLU was giving talks at the NCAA conference where we were like, gets pulled in by Athlete Ally a lot, you know, all of the network there of people trying to ensure that men have access to women's sports on demand.
I was talking to somebody last night who said that what he needed to argue with people about men and women's sports was statistics showing the increase in women's positions, awards, and scholarships lost to male athletes year by year. Because he said that the argument, when he has tried to bring it up with people, he says that they just say, oh, it's not happening, or it's just a few. It's just like so rare. It's just one or two. And I was like losing it with him because he needed this specific information organized this specific way. And I said, well, probably someone has done it. I don't need that information because I'm following the stories and there's like stories constantly happening. But I guess they're kept out of mainstream media or something.
There's more than 50 men competing in women's cycling alone.
Yes. Has anybody just, you know, just for the sake of my friend?
It's impossible to quantify how much has happened behind the scene, like without our knowledge. Right now in the state of California, I get pictures when it's track season on a weekly basis, but certainly on a monthly basis, from moms just sending me pictures of male athletes that are in every race their girls are in.
At what level?
Qualifying for state championships,
okay.
Taking their position to go to sectionals, taking their position on a team, kicking a Division I recruited athlete out of a chance to compete at a high school state meet, which, like, if you're a Division I athlete, you should be competing at the high school state meet, but not when you get beat by one or two boys.
The same friend said that I think he tuned into Rachel Maddow talking about the Leah Thomas event, and that was her argument that, like, why is everyone getting their knickers in a twist? It's just such a rare thing.
That is just so cruel to the women. I mean, like, let's take it to an extreme. If you, I mean, so there's two examples I come up with that men tend to care about. And that is, if you were, like, on Super Bowl Sunday and you sat down the two teams and you said, you know, just for this instance, this team has really needed to feel better about themselves, so we let them inject testosterone because they felt like their muscles were so small relative to the rest of the NFL teams. And they've had so much success this year because of it. They're feeling so good about themselves. And, you know, the team's making more money, and this is a positive for their community. We're just going to let it slide. Now, we all know it's happening, but we're just going to let it pass. And, you know, this is just fine. You just need to deal with it. It's only going to happen this once.
The thing is, though, Kim, if you knew who the Cleveland Browns are, you'd actually think that that was a pretty good idea.
But then you'd sit there and say, okay, so let's take it down a notch. So everyone's like, oh, that will never happen. But, you know, everyone threw up in arms over Deflategate, right, when it was just like soft footballs. But let's talk about altering the actual bodies of the athletes in a way that we recognize is totally unfair. And we know there are issues with drug testing, but at least we know people are doing their best to drug test, right? Like, there is at least an effort to say, okay, there's mandatory drug testing. We're holding on to blood vials and doping scandals and we do correct those old records when we find there is a flaw or something was wrong. We strip people of their Olympic gold medals, but let's take it down to the collegiate level, you know, where I don't know how many people run in the finals of the 100 meter dash, but we pull them all aside and we say, there's one of you, there's one athlete in this final who has been doping, but again, it's helped this individual so much. They feel so much better about themselves. They're running better. Their family life is better. You know, they're going to maybe get into college because of this. Like, we know it's unfair. We know you all know, but you can't talk about it. And you really shouldn't complain. And it's just going to be this one person. It's not all of you. So don't make it a big deal out of it. And then take it down to, you know, high school and say that we know one athlete that made the varsity team. One athlete that made the varsity team just needed the opportunity to grow a little faster, you know, was underdeveloped as a senior in high school. And his doctor told him he wasn't really going to mature until he was 22. And so this might be his last chance to play sports. So we let him inject some testosterone so he feels a little better about his body and it develops a little faster. And he might make the varsity team. Well, I mean, but don't say anything and don't worry about it. And this is the message we're sending to girls, that if it's their spot, if it's their spot, that one little girl that had her heart broken because she missed out on the time or the chance to play, or, you know, even the last chance to be on the varsity or the JV team, she doesn't really count because there's just one little boy that needed help.
And also they'll kill themselves, girls, if you talk about it. And then that blood's going to be on your hands. So you're basically a murderer.
Well, and I can't tell, since I've been getting more involved in this and I've now met with several of the governing bodies of sport, I mean, I'll just call it out. I was on a phone call and it was supposed to be discussing their policy, which was going to be to let self-ID be the way things ran unless they were qualifying for the Olympics and they had to use the IOC standard or the world governing body standard. And they brought these young girls on, 15, 16 years old, onto the call to preach to the rest of the people listening who were there to voice a negative opinion. These 15 and 16 year old girls were on there to say, you know, I'm just so much more worried about everyone being happy, and I love my sport and I want everyone to think my, you know, this sport is such a happy place to be. And the winning doesn't really matter and the ribbons don't really matter. There's plenty of opportunities for me. And I listen to that and I just think, oh my gosh, this the leaders of this sport are holding up these girls as examples of what sport is supposed to be for women and girls. And they're telling them, your job is to better others. Your job is to be there to lift up others. I spoke to a psychologist about this, and the psychologist said, they don't understand. They are creating, with these policies and with advocating and putting these girls up in these positions, they are creating a generation of domestic violence victims. All we're doing is teaching these girls that it is their position to take abuse, harassment, and, you know, to be stripped of their rights, and that that's what they're good for. Well, they can't, you know, leave. Pretty, they shouldn't be. That's unbelievable.
I totally agree. Of some of these administrators, though. Because if they have 20 girls and 17 of them are quiet and object, and three of them say, hey, this is great, let's make it inclusive for everybody. They don't have to get the 17 girls up to the microphone to talk about why they're upset. They only need to get those three or four girls and talk about why inclusion is so important.
Well, and the irony of it is they're using inclusion entirely wrong, right? So, I mean, I'm all like, inclusion is the way the world should be. We should be trying to include as many people as possible. But the way we do that is not by crossing categorical boundaries and things that have been created to include people. So if I want to maximize inclusion in sport, like, let's start with what I have at the ground zero, no categories at all. I have a world of sports opportunities for men ages 18 to 35. They're going to win almost everything. They're going to have all the opportunities, all the access. They're going to win all the championships. They're going to be the celebrated humans on the planet when it comes to sports. So then I say, okay, hey, you know, I need an opportunity to develop those athletes. I need them to be excited about training and develop confidence. So, you know, let's give them opportunities as youth and let's protect them relative as much as we can relative to development. And we do that by age, right? Because it's approximate. These are your peers. I mean, there are some people that are going to develop a little faster than others, but in a developmental cycle that should wash out over time. And this is the developmental process that we can say this is verifiable. We can't have everyone go in at age 13 and say, okay, you know, we're testing your bone structure and your height, where you are, like that you're on this percentile, so we put you with these folks. We can't go to that level of detail, but we can say we're really close with age. And then we go on and we say, all right, in some sports, your weight really matters. So we want to see these like amazing athletes that are a little bit smaller in size, where we're in a sport that weight makes an enormous difference and overcomes, you know, is like, it overpowers the rest of the attributes. Well, sure. I don't think, I was going to say boxing for weight.
Okay. Yes. All right.
Weightlifting, boxing, bodybuilding.
And weightlifting and bodybuilding. Okay, right. All right. So gymnastics doesn't really have a weight class. That's more like, the beauty of sports, like a lot of times you'll get an argument about like, oh, but basketball is only good for tall people. And then you'll say gymnastics is only good for short people. Well, but that's the beauty of sport. Like you can choose a different sport that your body is built for to maximize your opportunities of success. If you happen to fall in love with the sport that your body's not built for, you have to choose, you know, okay, I don't care as much about success, but I love this sport and I want to do what I can in it. So these are personal choice issues. But
there's always billiards,
chess,
music. I mean, this is why we have different disciplines across life in society, right? To celebrate excellence and achievement, to see what people are capable of, what's amazing and what's beautiful that we can create. So then you go, great, we've got age, we've got weight. Now, you know, we've got, even if we have disability now, we want to see what, we want to open up sport for people who don't have a leg or who are, you know, have been in an accident or were born with a missing limb or a developmental issue. So we have para categories. But if we have all those categories, we're still leaving out half the world's population, more than half, women. So we have a sex category. So if we're going to be maximally inclusive, we have to respect sex. As soon as we cross those boundaries, like we let a 25-year-old compete with the 14-year-olds, you're excluding a youth from their opportunity. As soon as you take an able-bodied athlete and you put them in the para category, you're excluding a para athlete. If you take a heavyweight and you put them in the, you know, in the lower weight class, because that's where they're going to have more success, you're going to be excluding someone who that category was created for. And the same thing is true for women. As soon as you take a male athlete, you put him in the women's category, you're going to be excluding a woman. So, I mean, these policies are exclusionary policies when they include a male athlete in a category where he does not belong.
I agree. Why do you think there are so many women like Rachel Maddow? When I heard this story about Rachel Maddow, I was like, she's talking about a story where women and girls are being hurt. There's evidence of them being hurt. And her response to this is, it doesn't matter. And it's not happening. And it's such a little
in
thing.
Sport?
Yeah. This was her response to Leah Thomas, right? Just, oh, it's just a few. It's just a few and it doesn't matter. And why are people getting so upset about this? And it really bothers me that there are women who respond to evidence of women and girls being hurt who respond that way, to just immediately minimize it because it's for the benefit of a man. I was also really annoyed with my friend because he knows this is happening and he was arguing that people will only believe it if you have these statistics. And I'm like, how many times does it need to happen for it to be wrong? I think one time is enough. Like in the past, people wouldn't have tolerated this. And it's like with the women, it's like, the women.
How many bombs do you need to drop before you know it hurts people?
Yeah.
How many people do you need to see publicly executed before you decide that's not a good thing and we need to stop it? I mean, it is. It's just the Larry Nassar trial part two. How many women need to get hurt before you decide to step up and say, okay, this person shouldn't be there? And it's the crazy thing is, I think this is such a huge psychological problem for women to overcome in communicating that they actually matter. Because we have, if you look at one, so we bring in one boy, let's take a middle school first opportunity that, a young group of girls might have to compete in sports. Like this is their first exposure. And a middle school team, and one boy makes the team and one girl then gets left off the team. So at least, even if no one knows that that's a boy, even if it's completely hidden and no one's aware and it's all under wraps, at least one girl got hurt, right? At least one, even if there's no contact, no injuries, no, it doesn't ever happen again. One girl got hurt. But the fact that we know this is happening means that every single girl on that team had to watch their classmate be dismissed because they were female and replaced by someone who was male because he was male. Every parent that knows it happened had to understand that the girls' team is open and susceptible to the priorities of other little boys. And every time that we don't speak up about it, we condone it. Every time we say it's okay, we say, yeah, we expect that our girls should be treated this way. We have to speak up.
What happened on the Harvard males swim team, though, where they had a woman come in and replace a deserving male swimmer?
That position has been argued. I've actually seen it argued on Twitter. Oh, that it's like this is happening on both ends. So the difference is that Skylar finished last. Like Skylar couldn't even make the travel team on the men's team at Harvard.
Yeah, so, it's like Mac Biggs too on the wrestling team.
Right. Well, so Mac was a girl who wrestled against other girls, but was essentially just like an East German doper, right?
Yeah, so, she was taking testosterone.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's no way sports should be a space for everyone in sports, but you do need to play by the rules. And I believe that means you shouldn't be altering your body chemically in order, you know, in any way that gives you an unnatural advantage. And by unnatural, I mean like facilitated by drugs or medication or medical intervention. And I don't think you should be allowed to use drugs, medication, or intervention to change the category of participation. And this is an argument I have made over and over, that we don't allow anyone else to do that. So there's no adult that's allowed to compete with children just because they have the mental development of a child, or because they are short, or because they've been sick.
I'm gonna jump in and ask some questions, because you've made a very, very strong case.
Oh, okay.
And on top of that, not only have you made a strong case, I think a lot of us are inclined to sympathize with it anyway. So I want to ask some questions that maybe haven't come up in other venues that you've had access to in the media. So one of the things that we know, all three of us know for sure, is that when we are vocal about these types of issues, we tend to get some pushback from our family. In my case, my mom says, "Why do you have to go out and make a target of yourself? Why don't you just be quiet and let other people advocate for themselves? Why does it have to be you?" Are you getting any sort of pushback from your friends or from your family? Are they supportive? Are they against you? Like, what's happened?
Well, I mean, no, I think almost everyone I talk to is supportive. I know that there are people that get uncomfortable. I mean, no one likes confrontation. I don't like confrontation. My co-founder and I, for the group we formed, we say at least on a weekly basis, if not sometimes on a daily basis, like, there's just a million other things I'd rather be doing than saying that women deserve to be treated with respect and fairly. Like, come on. I could be doing so much more for the world, for my family, than arguing for basic, stupid, common sense things. It's outrageous that we have governments and organizations spending money on defending policies that blatantly discriminate against women and hurt society as a whole. Like, this, it's just outrageous. It's so stupid. But I know you can sense people's discomfort sometimes. They're like, "Oh, I'd rather, you know, not talk about this," or but I think if we want to get back to any sense of normal life, of living where we have a balanced understanding of mutual respect among people, we can't be intimidated or frightened to talk about things anymore. And I think it was honestly the conversation I had with the ACLU lawyer that I called right when I realized that, you know, this was going to become a bigger issue in the Ivy League with Leah Thomas. As soon as I heard the arguments coming out of that lawyer's mouth, I was like, yeah, I'm done. I don't really care how uncomfortable I get anymore. And I don't care how uncomfortable other people are. That what's at risk here is too incredibly dangerous. And I think we all have a line that once it gets crossed, it just doesn't matter anymore. Like, you're willing to do whatever you need to do.
I bike a lot, and on a ride with my local bike club, I said to the person I was riding next to that I was going to go to Denver. I said I was going to Denver because I was making small talk. And he said, "Oh, why are you going to go to Denver?" And I said, "Oh, the Icons Conference, women who don't want men in women's sports." And he's like, "Yeah, I think I've heard of them." I said, "I really don't want men in women's sports. You know, a lot of men have just won a bunch of bike events lately." Mm-hmm. And he didn't say much, but then he said, "Well, I don't really have an opinion on this, but it sure does sound like when they were trying to keep blacks out of the baseball leagues." And I was just like, yeah, this is what it's like in my stupid town with the stupid bike club. And I I of course spent the rest of the ride just going like,
Nina, are there blacks in your bike club?
Not very many, because there just are not very many black people into bicycling in the area. I mean, that's not true, actually. There are black people who are into bicycling, but they don't go on long distance club rides. They use bikes for transportations, which the club people don't really do. Mm-hmm. They drive their bikes to the... I don't. I use my bike as transportation. But yeah, that was this guy's response. And it was just like, I cannot even. Like, there's no reason for me to talk further about this.
Let me summarize that. We should let men into women's sports because we should, otherwise we're being racist.
Yeah, that basically women with boundaries are racist is what he was saying, which is like pre-framed, and it like lets you know how you're regarded by this person.
Letting all men have access to sport and letting all women have access to sport, because we don't segregate sport by social constructs, religions, beliefs, and races, means that women shouldn't have their own sports opportunities. It's just makes no sense.
Yes. I did say to him, well, it depends on whether you think men and women are different. And whether you think black people and white people are different. If you think black people and white people are like really, really different, as different or more so as men and women, then maybe. But I don't really think black people and white people are really different, but I do think men and women are different. What I should have done, what I was kicking myself for not doing, was asking him questions, because that's how you deal with somebody like that. But I always forget. Yeah. You just go,
I tend to answer them too ahead of time.
Yeah. Why do you say that? What makes you think that? And you just keep asking them, oh, really? Why?
Yeah. Dig your own grave.
Yeah. But I forgot to do that.
Well, I went and had a 1-hour meeting with my federal congressman, Representative Jim Himes here in Connecticut, who I had voted for. He's a Democrat, works out of Stamford. And seems like a smart guy. He's a Harvard educated man, a Rhodes Scholar. He rode on the team at Harvard. And I went to his open house. I, stood up in front of everyone at the open house and I said, I need to ask you, Representative Himes, do you believe that women deserve access to fair competition? And do you believe that women deserve privacy and dignity in sex segregated locker rooms? Because my daughter in the state of Connecticut at Yale University had neither of those this year. And he was like, I don't have the card for this. I got a card to come have a personal meeting, and I enjoyed talking to him. Like, he's intelligent, and he conceded. He told me, he's like, yeah, I agree. Sex is not a spectrum. This is binary. There, men and women are not the same. You're not going to get me to say that. He also said, I agree, it's not fair that men and women. He told me he wasn't going to discuss the bathrooms or locker rooms. So that was off the table. And, but he said, I agree, it's not fair. And he said, I just don't think it matters that much. And my response now, when I hear, because now I've heard this a couple of times, my response is, you've just communicated to me that you don't think women matter that much. And here's why sports is so important, because it is the public arena of the difference of the sexes. And if we have different rules and different expectations for what's fair for women in the public arena, in the public eye, where everything is supposed to be based on fairness and everything is supposed to be about celebrating the limits of human achievement, if we can't recognize women in that arena, what in the heck are we going to do about the dark corners where women are invisible in prisons and in bathrooms and in domestic violence situations? This is a public decree of women's worth. And that is the reason why Title IX and women's sports over the last 50 years have elevated the position of women in society to actually being relatively compatible and equal contributors on so many fronts. I mean, we're not quite there yet, but it has raised. It's because when we recognize women as deserving of being champions, we allow them to understand and celebrate the differences in their biology and their development through similar achievements that we give to men in sport, then we've recognized them as distinct and valuable in their contributions and in their achievements. And as soon as we say it's not really, that's not really real, that was based on a lie, we remove that equality.
Kim, you're so eloquent on these issues. One of the things I want to know is how do you make carbon copies of yourself? How do you get the same sort of constructs into the heads of people in other states so that they can also contact their representatives and get them onto their sides?
You're so kind. I just think the more conversations we have, the more we research and understand our positions, the biggest thing that's holding people back right now is just fear. And I remember listening to a talk by Abigail Schreier when this was during the Leah Thomas situation. And I don't remember a whole lot of the points that she made during the talk, but one thing she said is that, you know, she talked a lot about the cost of speaking your mind. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about, oh, you know, do the neighbors push back or do you get silent treatment? But there are not nearly enough people that talk about the benefits. And I think those so grossly outweigh the negatives. It is, and she used the word liberating, and I copy that now. It is incredibly liberating to be able to speak your mind openly and to not care if you're wrong. Like, I'm sure I will make mistakes on this journey, but I'm human. That's acceptable. I can change my position on things. But what I have done is open my mind up to learning from any angle. Nothing intimidates me. Hand me a paper, I'll look at it. Hand me a book, I'll read it. Let me talk to someone who disagrees with me. That's fine. It is so freeing, and it helps you when we speak, we put our thoughts to words. And unless we can put our thoughts into words, we can't hear whether or not they sound reasonable or ridiculous, right? And when we have someone question us and push us on those audible thoughts, then we can start to formulate, you know, real foundational principles, and we can feel confident in what we're speaking about. We can move, we can think, we can move our brain forward. We can see pathways to solutions that we couldn't see before. So this fear of speaking has, I think, really paralyzed humanity. It's paralyzed society from making progress. So I'm an enormous advocate right now for speak your mind and don't worry about it. Just don't hold back, because if we're not willing to battle these issues and take stock of what parts of our arguments work and what parts don't, and how we solve problems, we're not going to go anywhere.
Well, it sounds like you have I assume you have a supportive husband.
Oh yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah. And I guess your kids, how are your kids dealing with it now, right? Like you said, your daughter was scared when this was going on.
Oh, terrified.
Is she still terrified? What's happened to her since?
No, I mean, it's been so, I mean, I guess these are some of the things. I mean, a lot of blessing. I told you, it feels liberating. I'm not holding back. I'm willing to speak my mind in ways. I mean, I think I still have a ways to go, honestly. But for me personally, it's made an enormous difference. And then for my kids, it's also made it. I think anytime an adult models freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and a willingness to seek and not to hide, I think you free up children who are, you know, also questioning and want, and I don't mind arguing with them about things. So I think it's been really, really good for family discussions and for their involvement in paying attention to what's going on in their worlds, and in their participation in life and discussions as well. So Raimi is my daughter. She's graduating from Yale just in a couple days. And she was terrified. It was a very hard couple months when she would come home and visit, you know, even over breaks, over Thanksgiving, after the the mandatory meetings. And I mean, they gave them t-shirts, they hung banners, they made announcements during every meet. They had people speak on the issues, you know, that trans people face. Like, they really drilled this home in every way, in every possible avenue. And she would come home, if I brought it up, she would like run out of the room crying. She just didn't, it was, and I've said this to someone else, it felt like she knew it was wrong. She was distraught about the situation. She felt like she was being robbed. She didn't know how to fix it. She felt entirely powerless, and she couldn't bring herself. One of the most common things I would hear her say was, "I'm just trying to survive this." And I remember feeling like, it's like my daughter is stuck in an abusive relationship she can't get out of. So I can only imagine I'm going to cry, because it was really scary, where there's no way to rescue her, right? There's no way to pull her out, because there was no authority. There was nowhere to turn. So that was part of the reason for forming ICONS, was even if we couldn't change the rules of the governing bodies, or, you know, inspire the Biden administration to stop tearing apart Title IX, even if we couldn't convince the schools that the girls needed locker rooms where they wouldn't have men in them, they needed a place to turn.
Kim, you're obviously very supportive of your daughter, and I'm sure that you've had some conversations with other parents of student athletes. But yeah, I also have to imagine that there are some students have parents who have probably said, well, what's the big deal? She's a woman now, and you just have to, like, she's just like any other competitor that you have to swim against. And this sure. is the world that you have to be in now. It's unfair. Why don't you just learn how to cope with it?
Well, let me finish answering the last question first, and then we'll go to that one. But so that was really tough. And then I think it was, by the end of the year, she wasn't ready for me to be public, but she knew that I was speaking out, and she was okay with me giving talks, and I would share with her the things I was going to say and confirm that I could say, you know, my daughter, I wouldn't say the school name, or I wouldn't say a teammate, or I would share just to make sure, because the biggest thing I had to do with everything that she had on her plate, right? I mean, this was an enormous toll to put on someone who's dedicating more than 20 hours a week to competitive training and trying to carry a full course load and keep your head above water. And then, I mean, you're dealing with personal relationship issues, boyfriends, you know, friendships, all the things that come along with college. And then you put this on top, like, it was, and it's in the public eye. There were photographers and newspaper people reaching out constantly and at all the meets. It was a huge, I mean, even if it had been fair, it would have been a big distraction, right? Even if there wouldn't have been injustice involved, it would have been a big distraction. But put it all on top, it was an enormous burden. So the last thing I wanted to do when she was going through that was ruin my relationship with her. I needed to be there as a support, right? So, I mean, if she had set me free and if she had been able to, I would have been banging down every door. I would have been talking to every single newspaper I could. I would have been scared, because I was just kind of learning how to speak out for myself on an issue, on a controversial issue. But I think when you see your child suffering like that, or you see a situation being built up that's so abusive, I mean, it's like watching a kid get beat up in a parking lot. You just couldn't turn away and do nothing, right? So I think now it was after the school year, and or right before the end of last school year, where she said, you know, I'm okay with you speaking out now. It's fine if you want to use your name. So it was at this last summer was when I was just like, okay, I'm done. I will use my name and my face and be happy to tell the stories and start advocating publicly for women. So Now this year at school, she has gotten really brave. She has not yet gone to media. I don't know if she will go to media ever to talk about this story. I think like many of the girls, especially the Ivy League girls, are going to look back on this event in 10 or 20 years and recognize how much abuse they endured. But I like all, you know, most women who have gone through a situation where it is psychologically torturous, you know, especially if there's both physical and sexual implications and injustice, you don't really, you're trying to, as she said, like get through the moment. And then until you really have time to process and look back on what was done to you with a little more wisdom and a few more years behind you, you don't really see how clearly it was violating basic fundamental principles of goodness and integrity. But she's gotten brave this year. She gave a talk at school about sex-based categories in sport and why they're important in spite of being intimidated by both the TA and the professor. She has spoken up. She's spoken to a lot of her classmates. She has given some talks on different platforms, but she just hasn't had them recorded. So she wasn't quite comfortable with them going out on media, but to groups of people. So she's going to law school. So her intention is to go to law school and fight for women after this experience. So when I first heard a story from her about where I thought, okay, she's really turned a corner. She went to this feminist talk at Yale where she started becoming a little more interested in those things. And she, at the end of the year, this was after the Leah Thomas saga was over, but the same calendar year. And she went and sat in to listen to these girls speak, and they were in school. And one of the girls got up on stage and said something like, you know, as women, we've kind of achieved equality now, and it's time for us to stop making excuses and to just go forth and accomplish the things we need to and start making the world a better place for everyone else. And my daughter called me after, and she was like, I mean, I'm paraphrasing. Actually, it was worse. and when she was rephrasing the things, it was just like, I haven't seen this. I don't think we experience misogyny anymore. And my daughter called me up and she said, these girls are so young. They just haven't seen the world I've seen yet. And I remember thinking, oh, she got it. You know, that was one of the first comments she made where I thought she really does understand. And from that point, conversations got a little deeper, but she's grown, I think, from it. If I could undo the experience she went through, I would undo it in a heartbeat because it was terrible and it was damaging. And I don't think anyone should have to go through it, but I'm proud of how she's evolving from it. And now I can answer your second question. Is that okay? Did I talk too
much? Yeah. So these girls that, young women, I should say, who have parents that maybe aren't supportive, like what's going on with them?
Well, interestingly enough, so I was, even during the year when I was being like anonymous, I was not anonymous to people. I was willing to talk to anyone face to face. I just was anonymous in media or publication. My name wasn't going out. So I talked to every single person except I refrained from talking to I'm sure you all saw Izzy Isaac Hennig, who was one of my daughter's good friends growing up. That was the woman on the Yale women's team. And I love their family. The Hennigs are wonderful people. I really enjoy them. They're intelligent and fun. They're loving, doting parents. They want the best for their kids. And then Izzy, I've seen Izzy in swim meets and growing up with my daughter the whole way along. And then Izzy was at the same time Leah was deciding, or at the same time Will was deciding to be called Leah, Izzy was deciding to be called Isaac. So that was another, you know, difficult thing that my daughter had to watch, you know, a teammate going through the inverse of what Leah was going through right with her. So, and of course she loves her friend and would do anything for her friend. So it was, that was definitely a two-way pull, right? You're trying to navigate your own fair treatment, but you're also watching your friend, and your friend is being supportive of what's hurting you. So, there, I didn't talk to Izzy's family. I wanted, you know, just, I assumed that was a, I tried to reach out a little bit as far as saying, you know, no matter what happens, I love and support you and I want to be there. But, and I was trying to be transparent about my position on things as far as I think women deserve access to fair sport and that this is not right. But I didn't push it any further than that. And, but otherwise, every single parent I talked to, I did not run into a parent that was on the other side of this, not one on any team. So I spoke with parents at Harvard, Cornell, Princeton, obviously Yale on the men's and the women's team, because I have a son on the men's team as well. So I was at both Ivy League championship meets, the Penn swimmers. Like I, there wasn't a family I ran into. I know there are a couple because there were a couple of girls that were, you know, relatively quietly supportive of the situation, but you're never going to have everyone. As I said, you know, as I've told people, there were women that didn't want women to have the right to vote either. So it's never going to be unanimous. You've just got to trust your gut instinct and go with it.
Leah Thomas has parents. I don't think that I've heard of any of his parents in the media.
Yep. Well, yes, you have. Well, Barry Weiss had an article that incorporated not any interview, not anything like that, but what, how they were behaving at the Ivy League championships.
How were they behaving at the Ivy League championships?
Proud.
Proud of their son.
Kicking the asses.
Go beat those girls, son. Go take them on.
Corinna, you're so base. yeah, just crazy. And of course, was, you know, friends with Skylar Baylor. So Skylar was sitting with Thomas's parents in the stands.
Oh, this sounds like a fun little event.
It was the worst event ever. It was...
Is that the one that Kelly J. Keen was at?
No, Kelly J. Keen was at NCAA's.
Okay.
So NCAA's were in Georgia Tech. The Ivy League was at Harvard championship. That was the conference finals. But it was, yeah, it was just sick and twisted. You felt like you couldn't get the all. I mean, I went because, and I went to the Penn meet also where my daughter raced Leah earlier in the season. But I went because I had to go to support my daughter. I do. Otherwise I couldn't have watched it. It was so, I mean, what I watched at Penn. So my daughter is 6 feet tall. She's really tall. And my husband is 6'8". So we've got a lot of height here in this family. And, there were so many, you know, like you'd hear, I'd read these news articles and it would say Leah Thomas, 6'1". And I just like, facepalm. And that's what it says, I think, even on Wikipedia right now or something says that Leah is 6'1". It's insane. I was 2 feet away from Leah at Penn. Leah made my daughter look tiny. My son, who was on the pool deck and went over and stood next to Leah because my son is between 6'3" and 6'4". Leah's taller. So Leah is at the least 6'4". And I would say 6'5", because I'm not as tall as my husband at 6'8", but taller than the rest of our family, who's quite tall, and you like a noticeable difference. So it's I don't remember why I'm starting to talk about height.
But I bet when your son was right next to Leah, I bet he really balled up his fist and wanted to do something, but then he remembered that he was taught not to hit cheating bastards.
Oh, I think at that point when we were at the Penn meet, everyone still thought this was gonna, this show would end at some point, you know, that I don't know.
Well, what's the current status? Is I heard he's not supposed to be swimming NCAA anymore.
Well, he graduated after that year. That was his last year of eligibility.
He graduated.
He put those girls in their place.
Well, now we've just got to get his name off those record boards. It's just ridiculous that you go into the Harvard pool and you go into the Penn pool and you go, if you went to the Akron pool in Ohio, you see a male name this being holding the records on both the men's side and the women's side. It's so infuriating. That lawsuit has to come because every woman that walks into that place, every woman and every little girl that walks into that place has to see a public statement that this university and the NCAA, they don't hold women as equally representative or equally valuable in their school. They don't have a place for them.
So what's the NCAA rule right now? Can men still compete with women?
Yes, 100%. So they said they defer to the governing bodies of sport and they defer to the IOC policy, which is just nothing. But they have also said that they will only adopt the policies of governing bodies of sport if it aligns with their values. And they did do a slide from their DEI, a presentation by their DEI committee that laid out like three or four nevers, what we will never do. And they boiled it down to, we will never guarantee women have the right to fair competition, because there's a slide that we have a screenshot of, but I don't have it right now. And it says things like, we will never require someone proof of someone's gender. So we will never question someone's gender. We will never make them require. We will never require them to prove their gender. We will never ban someone from competing. It was three or four nevers, things we will never do, that just essentially boil down to, women, you just need to wrap your head around that we will never let you know or have comfort that you have fair sports.
Actually, I'm okay with those rules. We don't really need to know anything about somebody's gender. We just need to know what their sex is.
Oh, Nina, you and I have a disagreement.
How so?
Because I will not give up the word gender. No way. Not okay. I will give up gender identity. Mm-hmm. You can have a personal belief or self-perception about what you should be or how you want to view yourself, but you don't get to choose your gender. So we should talk about this because I'd love to hear your response to my philosophy.
Sure.
You interested?
Yeah.
Okay. So gender is a euphemism for sex. And then secondly, if you want to take on the social construct or the social science definition that gender is a social construct and it boils down to the roles or, the way society has evolved to view one of the members of the sex, I believe that arises directly out of sex. So a man cannot redefine the gender roles or the gender expectations of women in society. It's up to us to break down those barriers, not a man, and vice versa. So a man can never claim the gender of women or of girls or of female humans. They can't claim that because it's not up to them to redefine. It's up to women to work it out in society, what it should look like. So those gender roles and those constructs are not stagnant. Mm. They change from society to society, culture to culture, time across time. So because they are evolving and because they change, men haven't changed it for women. Women have been the participants in those changing roles and constructs. So how we want our gender roles and our stereotypes, whatever those look like, we will be the ones changing those, not men.
Oh, that's fair. But Rachel Maddow told me that I'm a woman.
Did she really?
Yeah, she said trans women are women, and I'm in.
You're so in? No, you're not.
If women are making these rules.
Yeah, women, but women can't give away. So women could, say whatever they want to, but they can't actually give away the social constructs or things that create women. It's they arise out of sex. They arise out of our roles based upon our sex. I don't think it's along the same lines as saying, if I give something a new word, I change it.
So some rad femmes, I think, would argue that a lot of gender as a social construct of women, of females, has been created by men. And in fact, what we're seeing, I mean, you're actually describing it happening when these meetings are called, where the girls are told to be nice and to not talk and to be silent, that those are all gendered, it's all gender role, which is created by men, imposed by men on these girls.
But only we can break it down.
Yes.
Only we can bust that out.
Yes, but it's still been created by men. In other words, gender, so I use the words differently. One of the reasons I say sex instead of gender is that it's very ill-defined. Gender is very, very ill-defined. And yeah, some people definitely legit use it as a euphemism for sex. And mm-hmm. I know why. Some people use it as something else. And sex is unambiguous. It makes people uncomfortable because it's the same word as in the sex act. And that's why we got stuck with gender in the first place, because it makes people blush. But it's much less ambiguous than gender. And
I agree. No, I will use sex, and I will use sex when I am talking about, I will not use the word gender. But if someone tries to tell me that gender is different, I'll say, no, it's not. You can't co-opt that word for something else. And I think it's important for us not to, because it's tied to too many different legal cases and law arguments. So there's a lot of the use of the word gender in court cases and in laws around the country. The history of using gender as a replacement for sex is too strong, and too many women's rights around the world, not just in the US, depend upon us not forsaking that word. So, and in other languages now, so we work as a group, the International Consortium on Female Sport works as a group of organizations there's organizations like ICONS popping up around the world right now to defend women in sports. And one of the first things we did was come up with a lexicon, essentially a dictionary of definitions and how we'll speak, because language is just, it is the fundamental building block of how women are going to be able to articulate their needs and rights. So we have to be speaking a common language around the world so that the governing bodies of sport, particularly when you reach the international level, we're all speaking the same language and asking for the same things. And there are too many languages for which there is no difference between sex and gender. So we can't give it up. It's like cutting the baby in half. I don't have any problem if someone wants to talk about gender as a social construct or a social role. And I don't have a problem with someone being upset that men have, created some of those or tried to box women into those. But it's women's behavior and women who are going to break those down and change them, not men. Men can't come into the role of women's roles and change those stereotypes or those expectations in society. It's only women that are going to be able to do that. So I refuse to give it to a man. I don't think a man can they can be a feminine man. They can take on, some of the stereotypical roles or gendered roles of women, but they can't have the gender of women.
No, I agree with you. This is really a semantic issue. And again, probably. I focus on the word sex because there are too many people that need to know what I'm talking about. And also sometimes the word gender is used as a shorthand for gender role, gender identity. They'll just say gender.
Yes, and I don't ever do that.
That's fine, but other people do. And yeah, I know. And I call myself a gender atheist.
Which I love. I think that's great.
Yeah. So if you're talking about gender, it's like, fine. You could talk about anything else, witchcraft, your religion. I don't care. I just care about your sex. I want these sex classes acknowledged and sex differences acknowledged. No matter how deeply deluded you are, your sex doesn't change.
No, for sure. But I was just looking at the law in the state of California that outlines the rules for sports for girls. And, it was talking about sex-based discrimination. And then, of course, it interchanges with the word gender and male and female. And so if I read that the way those are written and I give up the word gender, there's no argument for me. There's no way for me to weave my way around that law to a logical outcome that protects women and girls. So I can't give up the word gender when it comes to discussions around law and what it means as far as how it's defined when we use it. So when someone says, oh, but gender is different, I say, it may be to have a different meaning. It's still totally associated with sex, and you can't divorce it.
So let's go back to the things this athletic organization will never do, right? They'll never question somebody's gender. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
They'll never question somebody's gender. And
well, I don't know if it was questioned, but basically they're not going to confirm it. They will never.
I just wonder if it was rewritten as sex, if they would stand by those statements. Because they chose the word gender because it's like, if they had used the word sex, it would be indefensible. And they chose the word gender knowing that it's this fuzzy language, knowing that many people will hear that and be like, oh, people's, you know, gender identity. They're talking about their gender
identity. You've got to know the history of sport. So what they called, so when we used to do the cheek swabs prior to 2000, that was for all Virginia Slims tours. That was what they called, you know, the professional women's tour way back when. That was long before 2000. But in the Olympic movement under the IOC, they called it gender testing. So that was sex testing. And that is what all the language is in those documents. So when you talk about doing gender testing, that is the cheek swab, the verification of chromosomes. That was the first level of check.
Will never question someone's gender. That's mm-hmm. insane. If they actually literally mean sex by that.
They literally mean sex.
I just use a different, it's like if they literally mean sex, they should say sex and try to defend that.
Well, but when they say that, they mean they're not going to do sex testing. So, and because those are the policies, those are the words of the policies historically used by the governing bodies.
It's very slippery, you know, because most people.
That's why I won't give.
Yeah,
that
no,
word
I up. Understand that. No, this is a good conversation. It's good to learn yeah. this, but they, you know, the choices of words that they're using are intentional and slippery, and gender, the slipperiness and the vagueness and the incoherence of the word gender. It's a great word for this movement. It's a great word for the genderist movement. They have gotten in so far where they never would have gotten with sex.
But that's why I say, like, you've got to call it gender identity. It's someone, like, I'll give up gender identity. Someone can think they associate with someone another gender, but they can't ever be another gender.
All right. I got a question.
Okay, so are we seeing a dead horse on this?
Well, no, I'm just moving us along a little bit because I just noticed something that I think we all agree on here.
Yeah.
And that is that this gender ideology movement has been very, very effective at taking over the language and taking over the rights of women. I think we all agree on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't this prove that men are smarter than women?
You're insinuating that it wasn't women that did this to their own demise.
Well, isn't that still proof that men are smarter than women? Yeah, checkmate.
Oh, maybe women are too smart for their own
checkmate, TERFs. Definitely the phenomenon.
Checkmate.
The phenomenon of women facilitating the domination of men is just undeniable. Women facilitating the abuse of women.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
It's shocking. It is. It's so unbelievable. I mean, oh, you just kind of peel the blanket off of this a little bit. And when you learn that there are women, I mean, there are women advocating for women to be locked up in prison with violent criminals. And you think, what woman would do this to another woman? How is it possible? Or that women, I mean, my gosh, I mean, just look at Leah Thomas. Leah Thomas was in a locker room in Florida with little girls, 8 and unders, on a training trip, stripped naked in Florida, where the laws are, you know, they think are supposed to be protecting them. And the other side is like, how can you get upset, you know, with someone being in the locker room? I should have access to the locker room just like any other human. It's like, we're upset because there's a naked man standing next to a strange little girl that he does not know.
I should say it's the man who's strange and not the girl.
He could be hurt by that little girl. That strange little girl could hurt him, could bite his dick off.
Yeah, but it's like there's...
Edit that out. No, Nina. No, no.
Edit it out.
Bad Nina. Bad Nina.
She's a very strange little girl.
This happened though to little girls in Florida, and you just think these poor children, they are dependent upon the adults making sure that these scenarios don't arise for them. And we are listening to the needs of these men.
Right. I was going to say that throughout the genderist takeover, the issue has been the absence or failure of adults and authority figures. So sports is very different from my field, the arts, film in particular, but there are these cultural organizations that have absolutely no integrity, and the adults are supposed to stand up. So when a little mob goes, you know, we're offended by this, and you know, you're bigots, this artist is a bigot, and if you show our movie, you're bigots too. What adults would do in that situation is like, well, you can think that, but we're going to go ahead with our program.
How did we get so afraid of people calling us names?
It's pretty weird, but the adults are not being adults, and we actually need these people in positions of authority to stand up, and they've just been capitulating all over the place like a disease.
We have seriously become a nation of early elementary school students who are afraid of someone calling you the mean kid.
In these positions of authority, it's like there's
crazy.
There's nobody taking legitimate authority. There's people just grabbing power.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But I...
Well, Kim, clearly there's going to be people out there who, even among our audience of, I think we have 103 people now listening.
Oh, wow.
Not to the same episode, just over time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure one of them or two of them are going to want to know what they can actually do to go forward. And by the way, we have a lot more. This is like a shtick that we do. We've got like, 105 or 106. I'm undercounting a little bit.
Each one contributes a dollar to our program. And that's how we afford Num Oil tofu at Golden Harbor every couple months.
Yeah. and it's actually like 4,000 or 5,000, but don't tell anybody.
Do you all live right near each other?
Yeah, pretty close.
Well, we're like 100
within a bike ride.
140 miles away.
Within a Nina bike ride.
Before my pre-COVID Nina bike ride. After COVID, I don't know if I could do it anymore.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, she's a avid bicyclist. She put in about 2,200 mile rides last year?
Oh my god.
22 centuries. No, that was the year before last. I did 23 or 24 centuries that year. I've been doing 8,000 miles a year. But this year is not going to happen because I lost 5 weeks to COVID where I couldn't even walk. And I've told myself I wouldn't do a century until 3 months have passed because I don't want to have a terrible relapse.
No, not fun.
Anyway, we want to hear about...
It was really terrible when Nina was sick with COVID and couldn't walk. Her mom had to drag her around the house and her mom's 80.
Wow.
Yeah. And Nina fought her the whole time.
Yes. Actually, no. Anyway, please tell us about ICONS, which I believe it's sort of an anagram and sort of not an anagram. ICONS?
Like it's the Independent Council on Women's Sports.
So IN is for independent and...
No, I is for independent. C is Independent Council.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then ON is O, right? Independent Council is O. But the O is also a female symbol. Mm-hmm. So it centers the women, Independent Council on Women's. And then, so the O-N is on, but then the female symbol is women's, and then the S is sports.
But where's the W?
The female symbol, Nina.
Oh, okay. That's how you avoid spelling I cows. Or
I'll show you.
Wait, so the N is for on. On with, no, I've seen the logo. I've seen the logo. Believe me, I just haven't deciphered it.
I'm just going to lay it out. I independent council on
women's. Got it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. It's challenging. It's a challenge. It's been challenging for me.
It's supposed to, I loved the concept of it because it centered the women in the middle of the name.
Yes. It's worth it. It's worth it being a little ambiguous or unclear.
We're happy with
it. Is this a membership organization? Do
volunteer based right now? For
volunteer.
Sure.
Well, you should take some membership.
I'd
sign up.
Yeah.
I'm an aspiring women's athlete.
That's right. But you're not going to change things, Corinna, no matter what gender you claim to be.
Oh, come on.
It's women who are going to fix this, not you.
But no, you do take donations.
We do take donations and we need them desperately. We are excited for what we're going to do for the next year. I mean, the stuff that we've been able to accomplish in the last year is pretty impressive. We've built out several relationships with different governing bodies. We have begun working with other organizations like ourselves around the world. We've worked with international governing bodies. We have connected scientists, lawyers, psychologists, doctors to do things in various states, you know, to help out the legislative branches. We have gone around the country testifying. We've gone around the world giving talks about the situation and in women's sport. We have written amicus briefs. We've helped to organize several other amicus briefs or groups of people that had stories to tell to contribute to all of the different court cases around the country that are dealing with Title IX and women's rights. We have staged protests. We have petitions. We've delivered. We've delivered a petition and staged a rally. For the NCAA. We've delivered a legal demand letter to the NCAA. We have connected governing bodies of sports with lawyers when they're trying to defend policy. We've gotten involved in several of those cases. We've helped out several women with legal issues in trying to straighten out their governing bodies. We've worked with several athletes to get their stories told. We've been published in over 1,000 different publications. We've written op-eds, been on television multiple times. Like in 1 year, and we've our reach has kind of expanded as far as our network into all the different aspects that affect women's sports, whether it's through legislative powers, legal powers, national governing bodies, international governing bodies, even some corporate relations. So we're excited. All of these things we're going to keep going. I mean, nothing's going to stop us. There's no reason for us to give up on any of it. It looks like there might be some big opportunities coming in the next year, but we definitely need the funds. We need to be able to hire real people. Right now, we're almost entirely volunteer based, and we need to be able to get ourselves officially established as an entity that's ready to grow by leaps and bounds so we can go, you know, change the world.
And most of you are athletes also?
Yes, almost everyone is tied to, so it's supposed to be a network of female athletes, but it's from collegiate and professional athletes. But of course, that's supposed to be the people that are there. We're a group that people can turn to, right? So also to leverage each other when we need help within just the athlete network itself. But it's also their supporters and their families. So we need dads, we need husbands, you know, we need people tied to women's athletes that are able to speak up and have perspective to share and position. We've been contacted by several dads who've helped us out in several of the court cases and even fiancés and husbands, but everyone has a place. And we need every voice. So it's important. There's not part of the network, and people will frequently say, like, what can I do? Well, obviously, the first thing that you can do is help us with financials, because we need to be litigating our cases in the courts, and we need the funds to be able to tell the stories that aren't being told. So we definitely do on Twitter serve as a bit of a news outlet for some of the untold stories that the media won't share. And we need the capabilities to develop small movies and shorts to tell these stories more effectively and get the word out. But we need this network so that we can lean on it when the time comes, when we need signatures or when we need people in a certain state because we have an opportunity to meet with someone influential in a state, when there's a tie to someone who has a certain skill, whether it's in or a story to tell. We need to be able to pull on people at a moment's notice, and that's part of what this network is. Like, what is your sport? Where do you live? If we can call on you in a year, or if we can call on you in a month or in 2 years, when something comes up, are you available and do you want to stay connected? And of course, then we have our webinars and we have our annual conferences to help get people informed, and we'll create content for that. It's just a good way to stay connected and informed. We hope someday to be able to have events where people can gather and just reconnect, because the athlete network, just being around sports and women who love sports, it's a wonderful environment, and a lot of people are, you know, deeply connected to it. So,
and when is your next conference?
July 21st through the 23rd in Denver.
Cool. So we're very, there.
It's going to be super cool. We have, so Emma Hilton will be coming over from the UK. So will John Pike to talk about the ethics of sport. Mara Yamauchi is coming over from the UK as well. So we've got lots of British. And I think Sharon Davies is also going to come over. And then Fiona McAnena, who's the head of Fair Play for Women, the sports part of Fair Play for Women. And then we've got Irina Aguilera, who's a sports lawyer from Spain. We'll have people from Canada and Brazil, Ireland, New Zealand, Australia. So there'll be a lot of an international flavor. I haven't got it confirmed yet, but there should be an international human rights expert on the rights of women, like the international treaties and so forth, that we need to understand as far as international policies. But there will be great scientists. So Ross Tucker, Emma Hilton, Carol Hooven will be there. And then we'll have a psychologist talking about how this is partially a psychological war on women and the damage that's happening to women emotionally and psychologically. We'll have Christiana Kiefer from Alliance Defending Freedom. She is one of the head legal counsels that's involved in almost all of the current litigation where athletes in America are fighting back on Title IX. So she's the representative for both the Sewell case, the Connecticut girls that had to run against the two boys. And then she is the lawyer also. She's involved in the West Virginia case where the ACLU is suing the state of West Virginia over their protection women and girls sports law, and the Idaho case. I mean, she's been involved in a whole bunch of these. So she's going to give us, you know, a play-by-play of where we are in the circuit courts and what the rulings have been, what the future looks like, what's coming down the pike. So that'll be a nice update legally. We have Bill Bach coming. He was for 15 years, he was the head of USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Mm. He was the head legal counsel during the Lance Armstrong cases at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So he's got an amazing background in sports law in the U.S. and internationally.
And he's a Hoosier.
And he's a Hoosier. He's in Indianapolis, yes.
Maybe he'd like to drive out with us.
I've heard of him.
We should all go together.
That should be fun.
It will be fun. So there will be some really interesting talks. I think it'll be good.
Plus, we'll be there, which will make it awesome.
And there will be social time, a lot of fun social times.
So, Kim, I especially want to thank you for very clearly connecting why women's sports are important to women's status in society generally. I think that's been missing from the conversation. I remember talking to one guest on our show, and she's like, they're just sports. She actually supported men and women's sports. I was like, why? And she's like, well, they're just sports. And I think you have really made a clear connection for the messages that treating women publicly as not mattering in a very public forum sends a message to all women and also all men in society in general. And it lowers the value of women in society. So it is important for everyone, including non-sporty people.
Oh, well, okay, yeah. Can I make one more point?
Yes, please.
Yeah, please, please.
Okay, so this that was part of our comments to the Biden administration for the recent rules just that were only sports related about Title IX. And when you say like it's only sports, right? Well, so we recognize that men are bigger and stronger. We recognize that the punch of a male is 160% that of a female. And as soon as we put in a man and a woman in a public arena and we say it is okay for the man to tackle or hit or strike or throw a ball at or kick, even accidentally, because we're putting them in the same ring and we know this is what's going to happen, we make it that much more acceptable for it to happen where it can't be seen. And so there is absolutely a physical and sexual violence component to this. And what we're telling the girls is acceptable behavior between boys and girls and men and women. So even if you don't care at all about sports and you don't care about the competition, you don't care if women can be seen as champions, if you don't care about at least the safety factors, you're advocating for there to be no physical recognition of the harms that men can deliver to women when it comes to the physical realm of living.
Yep. Stop pretending you can't see what your eyes are seeing.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And I guess we'll see you before too long.
Yes. Yay. Looking forward to it.
All right.
Well, God, we're right back in the same
talking
position that we were in
other.
The opening.
What's
Nina?
The secret of comedy, Corinna? Ask me what the secret of comedy is.
Bye, Curbs and Trannies. Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.